Glad to have all of you with us for Political Rewind today. It's February 11th if you're listening in real time, and that is a day that people who are political junkies have had marked on their calendars for months, because today is the New Hampshire primary. It's like Christmas for people who love politics, and we're going to spend some time during this show talking about New Hampshire and what we expect could happen up there, what it might mean as the race moves forward and eventually marches toward Georgia, with a terrific panel that we've assembled for today. Tamar Hallerman is with us. She's a senior reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and has become a regular since moving to Atlanta from Washington. We're so glad you're here, Tamar. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Right next to you, Lori Geary. Lori, the former political reporter for WSB-TV in Atlanta, a station that became known for coverage of politics. And Lori, you sort of spent your time in New Hampshire as political reporter at Channel 2.
Well, I had big shoes to fill, Bill.
Yeah, well, you more than filled them, Lori. Lori followed me in that job. But Lori now, in addition to the communications firm that she has, Lori Geary Media? Is that?
Yes, uh-huh.
Also is the host of the weekly show Georgia Gang on Fox 5, WAGA, Sunday mornings at 8:30.
That's correct.
You know, Lori, I was just thinking about that show. We're very proud here at GPB that this year Lawmakers is celebrating its 50th anniversary on the air. It's the longest running TV show in Georgia. But I was thinking the heritage of Georgia Gang, Georgia Gang's been on the air for 30 plus years as well. Isn't that right?
That's right, because it started out doing shows about the missing and murdered children of Atlanta. So that's been 35,
closer to 40 years.
Yeah, so yeah, it's been a long time running. Okay. And, of course, Dick Williams, it was his baby.
Yeah, yeah. So you can watch Lori on Sunday mornings at 8:30 on Fox 5. We're also joined today by Edward Lindsay, former state representative for Atlanta, and now a partner at the world's largest law firm, Denton's. How are you, Edward?
I'm doing great. Always happy to be here. Yeah. Fun group.
Yeah,
tonight.
It's fun to have you with us today. And Buddy Darden, former Democratic congressman from Georgia, 7th District, back in the days when that district, we said it before, sprawled from virtually the Chattahoochee River to almost the state of Tennessee.
To the Chattanooga city limits.
Yeah.
And a former state legislator.
That's
backed
right.
By popular demand.
You know what? I never mentioned that you served in the state legislature, and even before that, were district attorney in Cobb County.
That's
was
correct.
That? Yeah, that's right. First district attorney, then state legislator.
That's correct.
All right, fine. All right, everybody. We're going to talk New Hampshire. We'll get to that in a couple minutes. But let's look at some state news before we get there. We're all paying, I think, pretty close attention to the way in which this battle between Kelly Loeffler, the appointed member of the U.S. Senate, appointed by Brian Kemp, is beginning to do battle with Doug Collins, who's jumped into the race. And the intensity of this battle has, I guess, is not surprising, Tamar. It's picked up very, very quickly. It's gotten very aggressive. And why don't we start by doing this? Let me, if I can, let's play a spot that the Club for Growth has been particularly involved in this as a surrogate for Kelly Loeffler. And they've been on the warpath already attacking Doug Collins. Here's a spot they just literally dropped in the last day.
Borrow, print, spend, again and again and again. Year after year, it's the same song and dance from D.C. politicians, like Congressman Doug Collins. Collins voted to raise the debt ceiling, back nearly $400 billion in new spending, even voted to preserve taxpayer funding for the San Francisco Opera. Music to the ears of Nancy Pelosi. Tell Collins, tear up D.C.'s credit card. Co-sponsor House Resolution 149, recognizing debt as a threat to our security.
So if you're listening to that, you'll see it eventually in some digital form or on TV. We see a picture of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is, I believe, Tamar, the devil incarnate.
At least in these ads, apparently.
She's dancing in the ad. We, of course, see Speaker Nancy Pelosi ripping up the President's State of the Union
You know what
speech.
Kind of interview I want to see is somebody who does Photoshop for all of these groups, who gets to Photoshop pictures of people like Doug Collins next to Nancy Pelosi, next to AOC. There must be some great stories there.
But the fact, what's interesting about this, Lori, is that Club for Growth, I mean, many of the things they're attacking Doug Collins for are standard operating business in Washington. I mean, of course you vote to increase the debt ceiling, otherwise the government basically goes out of business.
Well, and you would also think that this would be an ad targeting Raphael Warnock, not Doug Collins.
Well, that's a really interesting point. Right.
I mean, you really can't get any further right than Doug Collins. I mean, he's more tied to President Trump. I think he's mostly tied to President Trump than any other congressperson, right? And Doug Collins is a fighter. We know he's going to fight back no matter what. I mean, that's what he does. And so to see this ad and to see Doug Collins tied to Nancy Pelosi, it's almost comical, you know, because, I mean, he is so far right and so conservative.
Edward, we should point out Club for Growth has never been a fan of Doug Collins because of the very things they talk about. They basically don't want to see any increase in spending. They're very, very conservative. So,
well, I serve with Doug Collins. Doug Collins is a friend of mine.
At the state legislature.
Doug Collins is no Nancy Pelosi. the fact of the matter is that these particularly third-party groups come in, and they can take some isolated vote that you did and twist it 16 ways to Sunday. And Buddy and I, who have both served in legislative bodies and cast thousands of votes, you know, you can. It's sometimes amazing how people can twist things around. I always said that, you know, you can take, go and find five of my votes, and you can paint me as the most left-wing radical pinko. You can paint me as the most right-wing fascist. You can paint me down the middle. But if you take five votes in isolation, you can paint somebody any way they want.
Given that, Buddy, nevertheless, this is part of the messaging. And yes, you can distort somebody's record. But what's fascinating about this is Club for Growth has also attacked him on his vote in favor of the farm bill and the bailout to farmers across the country. That measure, just like increasing the debt ceiling, these are things that President Trump has signed off on. I mean, he signed the farm bill.
Absolutely. They dinged me one time in one of those type of ads for supporting a study which studied the reproductive habits of fruit flies. So there's always something going on like this. But obviously, Goldilocks, Kelly Loeffler's behind this. So,
wait a minute. That was a kind of a cheap shot, buddy.
Cheap shot?
Yeah.
Goldilocks?
Oh.
What's wrong with that?
Oh, okay, go ahead.
and this is just part of it. And they talk about how these groups are independent. These groups aren't independent. They pretend that they are, but they're all coordinated and do these things. This is just another way to pour more money in the campaign. But frankly speaking, these ads, I think, and at least in my view, are comical and very counterproductive, and I just think they're off on the wrong track.
So I take it from your comments that you are not a fan of Kelly Loeffler as a senator.
Well, I'm not a fan of Doug Collins either.
All right.
Or Raphael Warnock.
We're all still trying to figure out what are the sexual habits of fruit flies.
I'm trying to figure out, is Doug Collins the big bad wolf?
Oh, no.
If we're talking Goldilocks,
Good point. Yeah. But there's not enough room on the runoff ballot after the jungle primary for both Doug Collins and Kelly Loeffler.
And Tamar, that's what we're talking about here. I mean, this is truly a battle for the heart and soul of the Trump voters in Georgia. And each of them is going to make the case that they are more Trumpian than the other as they move forward.
Yeah, there's two points I want to make on this ad to kind of put it into context. The first is kind of the Club for Growth and where they've come from the last couple of years. And a lot of these votes that they're dinging Doug Collins for are things that are very standard operating procedure in Washington. You need to pass a budget to keep the government open. You know, a farm bill is something you do about twice a decade. Raising the debt ceiling is something you need to keep the country going. Until about 10, 20 years ago, these bills passed no problem. They were standing operating procedures. It was groups like the club that started that have made them such a big deal, that have turned the, you know, forced a lot of Republican legislators, I think, to take more conservative stances on that. You see members like Jody Heiss now, who rarely vote for bills like this, which 10 years ago, I think, would have been a real problem.
Yeah.
Well, keep in mind, take one step further. Not only are they oftentimes bills that got passed with no controversy, they're bills that are very important to the people of Georgia. Let's not forget, agriculture is the largest industry in our state. We desperately need these farm bills to get passed and to move forward and to help farmers. A lot of times who are in dire situations, being the grandson of a farmer, I understand that, and so you got to keep that in mind. And I do disagree with Buddy on one thing. A lot of these third party groups aren't necessarily aligned with a particular candidate. They're aligned with their own pocket, in that they need these provocative ads in order to get people to send them $100 or $50 or $10 a month in order to keep themselves going, in order to be relevant. And sometimes it has nothing to do with helping a particular candidate or even helping a particular cause. It's their own continued lifestyle that they were interested
totally.
In.
Totally. And there's this whole ecosystem of groups, and they need the publicity. You do a provocative ad, a journalist like me is going to be more likely to tweet about it, more likely to write about it. There's another piece of context I want to flag here. You know, we're talking about Doug Collins's status as a really prominent, attack dog for Donald Trump, somebody who's really been able to defend him in the Judiciary Committee. How did he get there? He was a member of the Republican leadership team starting in late 2016. Part of the deal that you cut, if you become a party leader, and this is both sides, is you kind of agree when the party needs votes for something that's not so fun, like a government spending bill or to raise the debt ceiling or a farm bill. You kind of agree.
You've got to be there.
You'll be there if they need
that's
you.
That's a really interesting
and
point.
Because he was so good in that party perch, he was the number five Republican in the House for a little bit, that was what vaulted him into the top Republican position on the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you for saying that.
Well, you know, I know you all talked about this last week with President Trump's comments at the press conference.
Yeah.
But you really, when you sit back and look at these ads, you have to wonder how long Republicans are going to let this go on.
The comments you're talking about are Trump essentially with Loeffler and Collins both at his victory celebration in the East Room saying, gee, I think you'd like each other. Maybe we're going to work something out. Go ahead.
Right. Because, I mean, this is brutal and nasty, and they're not even paying any attention to any Democrat in the race. And that's a problem. And you also have to wonder, though, we're all wondering if Trump will take sides. And we know President Trump wanted Doug Collins to be the U.S. senator. But now he also has this loyalty to the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, after the acquittal, right?
Don't worry, I'll make a prediction. I'll make a prediction right here.
Okay, so we know that Mitch McConnell is supporting Kelly Loeffler.
Yep.
So does he stay out now? And does he work some type of compromise?
Yeah, but
of course he does. What they do is they find a nice federal judgeship for him.
A lifetime appointment.
A lifetime appointment. Move him up even to the Circuit Court of Appeals. That's plenty of room. When you're president, you've got all these levers at your disposal.
So that's your prediction. You think that's where this is headed?
I think you put him either on the U.S. District Court or put him on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Well, two points to add to that. This morning, there was, I think, a signal that was given by Trump in terms of where he will ultimately end up, and that I got a email from Newt Gingrich.
I'm glad you brought it up. Newt endorsed Kelly Loeffler today.
He was endorsing Kelly Loeffler. And I can guarantee you that Newt Gingrich would not have sent that out without pre-clearing it from the White House.
That was going to be our next part of the conversation.
Anything I can do to help.
Lori, an endorsement from Gingrich, who has, of course, stood strongly by President Trump, may very well be a signal that to Doug Collins, look elsewhere, buddy. We'll figure it out.
Well, his wife is ambassador to the Vatican.
Yes, Vatican.
And I think in your own party, you can never underestimate the power of a sitting incumbency, right?
Yeah.
I mean, she's now the U.S. senator. She's the incumbent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tamara, it's going to be fascinating to watch this play out. So we will. The Newt Gingrich endorsement today being the latest sign. I'm going to cross over to the other side of this race, the Democratic side of the race, and point out that Raphael Warnock, now only in the race for a matter of weeks, is already scooping up endorsements, the most prominent of whom is Jason Carter, the grandson of Jimmy Carter, the 2014 Democratic gubernatorial candidate. It strikes me, and Stacey Abrams has now started sending out emails. I bet everybody in this studio is getting them, saying the most recent one yesterday was, we can win with Raphael Warnock. But in the same way that the Republicans aren't coalescing completely around Loeffler, there's still some maneuvering going on in the Democratic side of that race.
At the same time, Warnock now basically has the party apparatus behind him, not only in Atlanta, where you have folks like Stacey Abrams, but in D.C., where he has the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which is typically only backing incumbents. Yeah. So Democrats came into this knowing this is a jungle election. There's a lot of peril if this race goes into a runoff. Democrats historically don't do well here in Georgia. So they kind of knew that they had to try and clear the field as much as they could for their candidate, and that's what they're trying to do.
But keep in mind,
Abrams' play here. Yeah. This is a Stacey Abrams play, which put Warnock in front of the DSCC because there was a lot of back and forth about who would get the DSCC endorsement. I called them, by the way, on behalf of Michael Thurman. I thought he would have been a much, much stronger candidate. In fact, as I told the DSCC, I've heard both Warnock and Michael Thurman preach, and Michael Thurman's a better preacher.
Well, I will say this, though, however. A lot of folks, particularly in this room and elsewhere, sometimes we get Atlanta-centric. The Democrats also have a damn fine other candidate running,
Ed Tarver,
who I served with in the General Assembly.
Yeah, he this week did file his paperwork.
A former state senator, former U.S. attorney in the Southern District, who did a very good job. And has built a network down in that area. So I think a lot of folks in Atlanta tend to sort of want to think only about folks coming out of Atlanta. But Ed Tarver is going to be a player. He's, like I said, he's a very serious-minded public servant and should not be dismissed.
I think it's more not as much Atlanta-centric as it is Stacey Abrams-centric. Yeah. I think once we saw, you know, her coming out and favoring Raphael Warnock, because she's got the money behind her, she has the network behind her, she has D.C. behind her, she has the country behind her. I mean, let's be real.
I apologize if I interrupt you. So I think we just saw something really interesting right in this studio in terms of Democrats and where they all stand. Buddy Darden a few minutes ago made it clear he's not standing with Raphael Warnock right now. And I suspect, and then we'll let him respond, but this goes back to the gubernatorial primary. This goes back to the contingent that we're backing, like Buddy, Stacey Evans. It did not align with Stacey Abrams. So let's talk about Buddy and his presence and that faction of the party.
Well, we're seeing this play out really in national politics too, right? We're seeing kind of the more centrist Democrats. Stacey Abrams will argue that she really did run on kind of kitchen table issues, but she really did run left of Jason Carter, Michelle Nunes of the world. So I think it's a generational effect too.
Yeah.
But Michael Thurman surely is a more moderate candidate than Raphael Warnock.
Yeah, but Buddy, you would say, I mean, you should talk about that, but you would say that this does go back to the very beginning stages of both Stacey's gubernatorial efforts and where you, Roy Barnes, and a few other what I call yellow dog Democrats, where you aligned yourselves. And I think your ongoing concern about the Democratic Party not being able to win elections if it's too liberal.
Yes, and that is a concern of me, but I also want to say that Edward pointed out something very important, and that is Ed Tarver can be a factor here as well. I think it's got to settle in yet, and it's a little early, but what people like me who consider themselves centrist, but yellow dog Democrats, don't like being told, you know, this is your candidate, and you're going to be with him, and this is the end of the world. So that's kind of where we are. I like to see the process be a little more open and a little more moderate.
Tamara, Buddy is not the only Democrat who's been in this studio in the last week and said, prominent Democrats too, we're not there for Raphael Warnock at this point. And the common thread has been, we need Michael Thurman in this race. And by the way, Michael will be on the show on Friday.
We'll be listening.
We maybe should ask him. But anyhow, but the point is, there is still some unsettled feeling about Warnock, partly over his philosophy of politics. And there's also this question as to the record he's established as a preacher. If you're a Republican or a Democratic opponent who really wants to go after him, you've got years of sermons to unpack that may find some things.
And all his future Sunday sermons that all of us can go to every week and pick through his words and see, is that a campaign statement? And the IRS will be watching too.
Yeah. Real quickly, before we take a break and then turn to other politics, Lori, I don't know what it's like on Georgia Gang, but Senate race number two, as we've been calling it, has become so dynamic in so many ways. The impeachment, now the primary starting up. Senate race number one, the David Perdue race, has just really become invisible.
We don't talk about it much at all on the Georgia Gang. And I feel for the Democratic candidates in that race because they're just probably chomping at the bit for attention and money. And I think it's really hard for them to raise money right now because there's no attention being played on that race.
But is that going to – we know that Tomlinson's had some trouble raising money. Ossoff's done better than the others. But he's still – I mean, David Perdue is in a league all of self. Of course, he's the incumbent. Will that change once the Democrats choose a nominee in that Senate race? Will the money start flowing in big numbers?
I believe it will. I need to, of course, be quite frank with you. I'm all in with Tomlinson because I think she represents the best chance.
Well, she's got all the endorsements.
And she will raise the money. This is not an auction. And I really don't think whoever runs against David Perdue will have anything like the money. But I think once you reach a certain amount of money, you reach the point of diminishing returns. And in my opinion, and I've said this many times with all deference to my colleagues here, most political money is wasted. And so once you have a certain amount, once you go beyond that, then it becomes something for the consultants and the people with a new product and other things to do. So we will have enough money for our Democratic nominee in race number one. I think the issue is incumbency because Perdue has become the person that he ran against 6 years ago.
I think overall, in the observation, kind of the big picture, I think when we look at these races and we see who wins, will this be about the money or will this be about where Georgia is? Is it blue? Is it red? Is it purple? Because the Kelly Loefflers and the Senator David Perdue have so much more money right now than the Democrats or, you know, the other opponents, will it matter? And I think this could be one year where we look and see where it matters.
Yeah. Well, and as far as the Democratic Party, the question is where the Democratic Party is, because particularly as it's lining up with the Senate race for the Democrats against Senator Perdue, you've got former Mayor Tomlinson from Columbus with a record as a mayor versus John Ossoff, who is an investigative journalist from DeKalb County.
Yeah.
So it's basically going to be urban Atlanta versus rural Georgia or outside the perimeter. For the Democratic Party, and the question is, where is the Democratic Party ultimately going to
land? Well, and that's crucial tomorrow. I know you can say what you want, but let me throw this at you to also answer. We have a hard time in this state electing people who aren't from Metro Atlanta. You've got an Ed Tarver Augusta, you've got a Teresa Tomlinson Columbus. Yeah. It's the Metro Atlanta candidates who have the easiest time usually getting the attention and the money they need. But go ahead.
You want to know my prediction is that it'll have very little to do with who these people actually are as Democrats and more about the broader where the party is going. So who the Democratic nominee for president is going to be, who is ultimately picked in Senate race two, and how much attention and excitement does that drive.
Well,
because
all
of these races, including the House races down ballot, they all move together.
And I'll go one step further. That's going to be the most interesting thing in 2020. And it's not just who's the presidential candidate will impact the Senate race, the congressional race, but it's going to impact who's going to be your state representative, your state senator, your DA, because so many elections that I'm seeing now are nationalized, even though they are very local races.
Right. One, Buddy, you get the last word in this segment.
I just wanted to point out, if this is the appropriate time for this segment, that I went to two Democratic fundraisers sponsored by Kelly Loeffler, one for David Scott at her house a number of years ago, and one at their business for the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, who was a Democrat, Senator Blanche Lincoln from Arkansas. So what I'm saying is, this is going to be a very, very muddled kind of race before.
Yeah, I think there were people who were a little taken aback when Kelly Loeffler chose to attack Mitt Romney for his vote to convict the president when she had given him a considerable amount of money, Lori, in his presidential race. I think people were a little shocked she would attack him in general, but beyond that, having supported his campaign for president.
I think people maybe on the outside were shocked, but were the political observers, you know, when she's up against Doug Collins?
You're right.
Right?
You're right. You're right. Yeah. Maybe I'm more naive.
All right, let's do this. Be a little too cute.
Yeah. Let's get a break out of the way. And when we come back, we are going to turn and talk about New Hampshire, which is unfolding. The polls have been open in most precincts in New Hampshire since 7. Some don't open till 8 because they're locally run. But people are voting, and we're going to talk about what that means when we come back. We're back on Political Rewind.
It went nuts.
See,
yeah.
Lindsay is just talking.
Sorry.
I get no respect in this room.
Would you take control of this show?
I'll do my best.
Yes, please. Before
we talk about New Hampshire, I just want to, and you're the perfect group to have here today, especially I think you, Buddy, but probably you too, Edward. I want to make note of the fact that we lost one of the Georgia Republican Party's kind of most remarkable forces back in the late 80s, the 90s. Dot Burns died yesterday down at St. Simon Island, where she'd been living. She happens to be the mother-in-law of Eric Tannenblatt, our frequent panelist. Dot Paget was a Republican when being a Republican in Georgia, Buddy, wasn't cool.
That's right. Dot Burns.
Dot Burns. I'm
Dot,
so sorry.
Dot Burns was a real deal. And she always believed from the time she started in the politics until her death that it was all about the Republican Party and building the Republican Party and the principles of the Republican Party. It wasn't about the money. It wasn't about the trappings. It was a philosophical belief in what she was doing. And my brother, John, who lives in Gainesville, had a very high regard for her. He's a physician there. And, of course, as you know, Dot's husband is a physician. And they are highly respected. And I think she probably did more for the Republican Party to give it credibility and respect than anybody on the scene today.
Yeah, Edward, Dot Burns was out of Gainesville. Yep. She went to work. She worked with Paul. I remember her very vividly back when she was involved working with Paul Coverdale when he was in state legislature.
That's great.
And she was a little woman, not very big, but fierce. She could be incredibly fierce. She had kind of white cropped hair. And as Buddy says, she was just completely committed to the Republican Party principles.
A force of nature.
Yeah.
and someone who helped build the two-party system here in Georgia. And I'm a great believer in two parties are better than one party dominating constantly, because you end up with better government when you have two strong parties. And we will all miss her.
One personal note is that back in those days when Paul Coverdale used to love having Saturday morning news conferences, because he figured he'd get on TV on a Saturday night when there wasn't much news he believed happening. And one of my fondest personal memories about Dot is that I used to bring my son to Paul Coverdale's Saturday morning news conferences when he was, 4 years old or whatever. And as fierce as she was and as steely as she could be in dealing with a lot of people, I have such vivid memories of how sweet she was in taking my son in hand and talking with him and entertaining him while the grown-ups in the room were dealing with politics. So I just wanted to say a few words, and I'm glad you joined me in that.
An absolute class act.
Yeah. So our condolences go out to Eric and to his wife, Mary, on the loss of a remarkable public figure, but also obviously a remarkable family woman. All right, let's talk politics. Tamar, so here we go. It's New Hampshire Day. I'm going to just go over, and I know these figures are familiar to those of you in the studio, but let me set it up. Let me start by saying, this is the day tomorrow when normally we think, oh, thank goodness, New Hampshire is going to begin the winnowing of the field. We see no indication of any sort that that's going to happen today. So let's just look quickly at where we stand. Quinnipiac released a poll yesterday. Their polling is kind of one of the gold standard polls out there. And this is what they found after the weekend of polling. They put, as most polling does now, Bernie Sanders out front, 25% of the vote. Biden, 17%. Well, this is national, I should say. I'm sorry. This is the national polling. Bernie out front at 25. Biden in second place at 17. But then we've got Pete Buttigieg right on his heels. And amazingly enough, all of a sudden, Michael Bloomberg is up there in third place. But in New Hampshire specifically, it's Bernie Sanders is the one who everybody says you've got to beat. He's out front.
Yeah. And, you know, he's from the neighboring state of Vermont. So people are very familiar with him in New Hampshire. He did really, really well there in 2016 over Hillary Clinton. And the reason why you mentioned how normally we have such a great picture of what's going to happen in New Hampshire is usually the Iowa results are a little more conclusive. Yeah. And the results were so muddied last week. And we're only just now seeing, you know, Pete Buttigieg might have gotten more delegates in Iowa, but Bernie Sanders might have gotten more votes. And so everyone is declaring that they're a winner. And it seems like there are at least five or six candidates who still are going to make it through these next couple weeks. So then you have a front runner like Joe Biden, who's really downplaying how he'll do in New Hampshire and saying, no, wait and see how I do in South Carolina and Nevada, where there are more voters of color, where it looks more like Georgia and the rest of America, and you'll see me come back.
In some ways, Lori, it strikes me that it's the trend lines in New Hampshire specifically now that are most interesting to keep our eye on today. Buttigieg has had an extraordinary rise since Iowa, where he came in first, arguably. Biden has fallen off a cliff in many ways in the New Hampshire numbers. And interestingly enough, all of a sudden, Amy Klobuchar is getting a lot of attention. One of her rallies this weekend, the police had to turn people away from the event. There were about 1,000 people in a hall, apparently, but it was so crowded that they had to send people to an auxiliary room. So those trend lines seem to be moving up at just the right moment. Elizabeth Warren has fallen off a bit, but the kicker is there's a double-digit percentage of people who say, as of yesterday, they weren't sure who they were voting for.
because there is really no front runner. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of excitement around Bernie Sanders, but and I think it also goes to the fact that, you know, a lot of people say, well, there aren't a lot of delegates, you know, in Iowa and New Hampshire, and it doesn't really represent, you know, the majority of what the country looks like. But this is all the media talks about for weeks and months at a time. And so if you don't do well in these states, you lose this momentum. I mean, ask Rudy Giuliani, right? So everybody's been talking about Pete Buttigieg. Everybody's been talking about Bernie Sanders, even though there was no outcome for a week of how either one did in the Iowa caucuses. But they've been out there. The media has been – I even heard on the way in, everybody's talking about Bernie Sanders' campaign manager. He's on the air. He's talking about how they're going to win and how they're going to message. So that's where the momentum comes in. That's where the money comes in. And I think the biggest disappointment is Elizabeth Warren showing. I mean, these are her states. These are where she's worked the hardest. I mean, she's in New Hampshire, and she's not doing as well. And this is – I mean, if there's anybody who's, you know – kind of the balloon is deflating, I think it's Elizabeth Warren, and I think we'll see that in some of her fundraising numbers going forward.
Buddy?
A vast majority of Democrats, which includes me, is for the candidate they think can beat Donald Trump. That is the ultimate test as to who you support. And in my view, Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders are not electable against Donald Trump. Now, I served in the House of Representatives with Bernie Sanders, and he's hard to love. Elizabeth Warren comes across as a woman who comes in and wants to speak to the manager always. And you know, what we have here is people, I think, kind of like me, sitting back to say what's going to happen here. And Michael Bloomberg is moving up, too. You saw that by a few indications in New Hampshire. Plus, his partner of many years, Diana Taylor, is going to be here at an event, fundraising event, this Thursday. So you've got the Bloomberg initiative, which is fueled by a whole lot of money, and a real sincere doubt on behalf of the Democrats of who can we nominate that can be elected. And right now, people are losing faith in Biden because they see him going down and not doing well, and then they're kind of moving to Klobuchar, I believe. So I think all these factors are in play.
If I can step back a little bit sort of and look at New Hampshire historically, its role has never really been picking whoever the nominee is for a respective party. I mean, it's never really been a very good indicator of that. But what it has historically always been is a winnowing of the field. It's to show who coming out of New Hampshire should be considered viable and who's not. That's changed in this year in particular. And now instead of New Hampshire fulfilling that role, we have a combination of early polls, debates, and fundraising. Think about the folks that have already been winnowed before the New Hampshire voters vote, including such folks as Cory Booker, yeah. Kamala Harris, a former administrative secretary, Julian Castro, and other governors and other senators. The field is no longer winnowed by a state like New Hampshire. It's now winnowed, you know, in the fall by things that have nothing to do with a voter ever
in
entering the booth.
In part by the media primary.
And the media primary. But that's my whole point is that things have changed. And so the question is from here on, what role will New Hampshire and Iowa now play, given the fact that who decides who is viable and who's not takes place way before the first vote is ever cast in those two respective small states?
Tamar, anybody who pays attention closely to New Hampshire primary day knows that the big deal – some reporters can't help but make the trek to Dixville Notch, which is located about 18 miles from the Canadian border in the far northern reaches of New Hampshire, because Dixville Notch and a few of the communities around it, there's a state law in New Hampshire that if you have a community of under a certain number of people, residents, you can cast your votes right after midnight. Dixville Notch has always done that. The results in Dixville Notch are virtually meaningless for the rest of the state, but it doesn't stop dozens of reporters from showing up. So the Associated Press just said, former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg won the votes of a tiny New Hampshire community that barely hung on to its tradition of being among the first to cast ballots in the presidential primary. That's because they couldn't find enough registered voters. You have to have at least five. They finally did. Dixville Notch's five residents cast their ballots just after midnight Tuesday. Michael Bloomberg received three write-in votes, one from a Republican, two from Democrats. The remaining votes went to Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders. Just as a little note to start the count off, right?
Sure. And you know, it's worth noting about Michael Bloomberg, he hasn't really stepped foot in New Hampshire. No. So that's pretty notable when you think about it. But I want to piggyback off something Ed said. And so much of the importance of New Hampshire and Iowa are kind of setting a tone, setting a narrative, setting a sense of momentum, whether that's real or not. But that does matter when it comes to fundraising. And you look at somebody like Joe Biden, who is a pretty big campaign operation to sustain, who's been spending a lot of money, who needs to keep that up. And so if you're coming out weak from these results, you know, you're coming in fifth in New Hampshire, that makes it a lot harder to keep fundraising and showing, hey, I am still the most elected candidate against the most electable guy against somebody like Donald Trump. And that's the challenge that Joe Biden's going to face.
So, Lori, one of the reasons it's valuable for us, I think, particularly to look at what Joe Biden's fate could be, is that he's won the support of so many Georgia elected officials. I mean, he is by far the choice of everybody from the mayor of Atlanta to any number of state legislators and others. And he appears to be vying for fourth or maybe even fifth place in New Hampshire.
But I think that you cannot discount the importance of the minority vote, and it hasn't been tested yet.
Absolutely.
It will not be tested until we get to South Carolina. And I think that's where Pete Buttigieg will struggle. I think it's where Michael Bloomberg will struggle. There's been a leaked tape today about the stop and frisk and things, the comments that he has said, which would be very damaging in the African-American community. So I think we'll have a better handle perhaps after South Carolina. And I think if you think back, you know this, back to 1992 with Bill Clinton, he didn't win a lot of states, right? Early on.
Right.
And so, you know, and I think, gosh, we don't even know we're not even close to a front runner right now. So I think we really have to see where the majority of the party will end up, especially minority voters.
Although it is worth noting, buddy, that this Quinnipiac national poll does show Joe Biden dropping 22% of his African-American support across the country since Iowa. That is startling for him.
It's troubling. It's troubling. And what it does, it discourages the people who are already with him. That's the real danger there, is the fact that if you come out for Joe Biden and you think he's the one, and then all of a sudden you look around and people are falling off, then the money doesn't come in. And he's got, as we've all talked about, the firewall in South Carolina, but that's even more true now. And that puts a total pressure. If he doesn't do well in South Carolina, he's finished.
But you would agree with Lori that Iowa, New Hampshire, not the tests that Joe Biden needs, even though they could weaken his campaign as he heads south in terms of fundraising particularly. They already dropped ads. They didn't have the money to pay for the TV ads they'd booked in South Carolina and Nevada. So the money is going to be an issue no matter what.
Well, I think more than ever before, especially by the results we saw in Iowa and now what we're seeing in New Hampshire, I think these two states are becoming irrelevant. And I would be surprised if there's another Iowa caucus in 4 years like we had this time, because the states have changed. They're all lily white. They're not representative of the United States in general. And I think the DNC needs to step in and change the program.
And I think the same is true for New Hampshire. I'll be real surprised if New Hampshire continues to hold its coveted place as the first primary in 4 years, given the changing demographics of this country and given the changing demographics of the center of the Democratic Party. Getting back to the issue of Biden that you raised, the question is, and we'll discover it in South Carolina, is he a wizened veteran who could come out scarred but strong out of New Hampshire, or did he have a glass jaw? And it turns out he just doesn't have what it takes. And we'll find that out, I guess, in 18 days from now. But I will also tell folks this. Is right now, I think around this table, we can come up with reasons why just about everyone who is now still in the game in the Democratic primary can't possibly get the nomination.
Yeah, yeah.
But one of them will.
Yeah.
And the question is, given whatever negative they may have, and each of them has a significant negative, which one can pierce through that negative part of their background and seize control? And that's what we're still waiting to see between now and Super Tuesday, when the folks here in Georgia and elsewhere start voting.
Yeah, before I take a break, Tom Fauci sent me a headline from Politico. They just moved it. It's apropos of our conversation tomorrow. This Democratic field is so flawed that even Biden still has a chance. That's, I assume that's an op-ed piece. I haven't had a chance to look at. Oh, Ryan Liz, that was a Ryan Liz's story. I mean, Ryan Liz is a very careful, close observer of politics. Lori Geary said something interesting about Clinton in 92, because one of the things we're going to watch tonight, Lori, is the spin that each campaign puts on whatever their numbers are. And I think we could argue that every single one, well, maybe not everyone, but most of these candidates tonight is going to be able to find a rationale for continuing to Nevada and then South Carolina. So the spin will be fascinating. In 92, when Clinton finished second in New Hampshire, after the Jennifer Flowers scandal had hit him hard, he came to Georgia the very next day. So I was brought in late on the night of the New Hampshire results to do a one-on-one interview with Clinton. And on the way into that interview, one of his campaign press people turned to me and said, and this was before it became public, I wasn't the only one, other reporters have been given this line too, certainly, turned to me and said, come on, let's go see Governor Clinton. You know, this proves he's really the comeback kid. And that line stuck with him throughout that entire campaign. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'll watch the spin tonight at the end of the evening. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way and come back and talk more about politics on Political Rewind. Let's finish up Political Rewind today. Lori Geary is with us, Tamar Hellerman, Edward Lindsay, Buddy Darden. Tom Faust pointed out we have, if you're watching on Facebook Live, the journalists are on the side of the panel of the table to my left, the elected officials on the right. So clear dividing line down the middle.
I like to say recovering journalists.
Recovering. Yeah. That's right. Yeah,
and recovering politicians.
That's right.
That's exactly right.
Buddy, I've asked this question several times, but you're a veteran of Georgia Democratic Party politics, so it's an appropriate question to pose to you and then bring the rest of the panel in on. We talked a minute ago about Biden, this sense that Lori has that we haven't seen the African-American vote. We'll see it in South Carolina, so it would be a mistake to say his campaign isn't getting anywhere. But you're worried about it. What happens to the Georgia Democrats who have gotten behind him? Where do they go next? New Hampshire may tell us a bit about where they'll go if Biden cannot survive all the way to Georgia. We may start seeing what they think as they see how New Hampshire goes, how South Carolina goes. Where are they going to go?
Well, Biden would quote Mark Twain, and he would say that the reports of his death, have been highly exaggerated. And the situation is, I think we might be getting a little ahead of things because this politics changes, from day to day, from hour to hour. Assuming that your hypothesis is correct in that he doesn't do well in South Carolina and then he comes out of it, where do the Democrats go? I would say Klobuchar would be a reasonable choice. However, I've been very surprised at the enthusiasm and support that I've seen cropping up for Bloomberg. Now, it's not spontaneous. It's well-fueled.
He's already built a pretty sizable organization here
in
Georgia.
And I didn't attend the event at Pascal's, but I understand it was well attended and by a lot of very prominent Democrats. And so I think we're floundering a little bit. We're in a wait-and-see position. I think the first choice would be if Biden remains viable, yes. But assuming just for the sake of the conversation that he doesn't, they'll be all over the place, primarily, I think, towards someone like Klobuchar.
Real quick, tomorrow, President Trump was in Manchester last night, had a big rally. He's on the ballot, and he's expected to win virtually all the Republican votes. But he's on the Republican ballot, of course. But one of the things he said last night was he encouraged people who support him to choose who they think is the weakest Democrat, would be the weakest against him, and go and vote for them, which if you can do under certain circumstances in New Hampshire, we won't get into the complications of it, but people can cross party lines or independents can vote either way. I've never heard a candidate, her or himself, actually encourage people to do that. And it usually doesn't work no matter who's saying it.
Because I remember hearing echoes of that in 2016 where Democrats were saying vote for Donald Trump because he's not the electable one.
Yeah.
So
that's
careful,
how well that works.
What you tell people.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we have a Georgia tradition with that because a lot of Republicans back in 1966 went to the went and voted in the Democratic primary for a guy named Lester Maddox who couldn't possibly beat Bo Calloway. And next thing we did, we ended up with Lester Maddox. But to also sort of pivot back to the to 2020 and the primaries, keep in mind it's all about delegates at this point. And while we focus on South Carolina and Georgia, the primaries, a big primary on Super Tuesday now is California. And I was reading yesterday about the two organizations that are working the hardest on the ground in California are Mayor Bloomberg and Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lori, we should put everything in perspective. New Hampshire today on the Democratic side mm-hmm. will end up apportioning 24 delegates to the Democratic convention. By contrast, When Georgia votes on March 24th, there will be 105 delegates at stake. So just to put it all in perspective.
That's what I said. It's still very early. I know that, you know, people watch the CNNs, the MSNBCs, the Fox News, and they think, oh, my gosh, you know, this is it. But there's still a long way to go.
Buddy, you want to get the last word in?
I want to get the last word in and say that Edward is eminently correct, because whenever you try to get involved in other people's politics, it always backfires, and we can thank the Republicans for bringing us Lester Maddox in 1966. So, and there have been other examples on both sides,
yeah,
by the way. So I think that's not a very wise thing to do by the president.
All right. We are going to be watching tonight closely. Everybody, you all stay up late for this?
No.
Buddy says no way.
I watch Perry Mason.
I do. I get a bowl of popcorn, and I'm all in.
I can't help it. Political junkies.
I'm with you. I'm with you, Lori Geary. And you don't have to worry anymore, because your portfolio is so much larger than politics now.
I can pick
tomorrow.
And choose issues to write about as I see fit. Pretty nice.
All right. We are completely out of time for today's show. I really appreciate everybody being with us for Political Rewind. We'll, of course, be back here tomorrow. Well, you can listen if you only heard part of the show at 9. We're back on the air at 2. Tomorrow morning at 9, we've got a panel of analysts who are going to come in and talk with us about what happened in New Hampshire, what it may mean moving forward. So I hope you don't miss that show. And of course, you can always listen to our podcast. You can listen to us online at politicsgpb.org. I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can get Political Rewind, and I hope you do. I'm Bill Nigut. See you later.